Okay.
First of all, I wanted to talk to you about juggling in prison, juggling with prisoners. How did you get started? How did that come about?
When I started juggling at San Quentin, there was already a juggling program established there. So I don't know exactly how long it had been going on, but the man in charge of the arts programming named Jim Carlson decided that juggling would be a great thing to bring to prison, and he's just one of these, you know, visionaries and pioneers, and, you know, he had drama and theater and music and writing and art, and he went out into San Francisco into the juggling community, and he started recruiting jugglers to come there, and so people started juggling there. And the thing that he loved about juggling was it forced people to work together. So he was really interested in guys learning how to pass together and learning how to keep that rhythm together. And that's what he loved about it. And he learned to juggle. And he was this administrator in the prison, and he always had a set of bean bags around. And if he was hanging out and there was an inmate nearby, he would say, "Hey, you know how to juggle?" And the guy would say no, and he would teach him, and then he'd give him the bean bags, you know. So he was great, and so he would just kind of recruit. And I was one of the jugglers that volunteered, and I was probably one of the only jugglers who was actually available to do that kind of job. I didn't have a regular job, and I wasn't making a fortune street performing like a lot of the other jugglers in San Francisco were. And so he asked me to write this grant, basically, from the state of California that brings artists to prisons, and then the prison system matches the grant. So that's what I did. And I started about 6 years ago. Yeah, I guess it was around 80... probably before that. I probably volunteered in 87 and then started in 88. I spent about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years at San Quentin at least, and then 2 years at Vacaville, which is a prison for physically and psychologically ill inmates.
At the time you started at San Quentin, it was a maximum security prison?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what sort of people were you working with there?
I was working with very thoughtful men, meaning men who had a lot of time to think a lot about their lives. I believe most of them were in for murder, and there were some rapists and some kidnappers. But that was about it. They were all in for life at the time when I first started. I was scared. prison's a scary place, I think, for everybody. And, I was scared at the beginning. And at the beginning, Jim would come down with me just for the first few times, and then he stopped, and then it was just me down there. And also at the time, were you ever at this spot? We did this spot, it was in the education building. And you'd walk in, and you would keep walking downstairs. It was literally 3 flights below sea level. And then you'd go, ground level. And then you'd go all the way to the back of this maze of a building. And we were extremely isolated in this corner of this building. It wasn't even really a room, just kind of a corner of a building. And the officer would come check on me about once a session, it was a 3-hour session, and you could hear him coming because you could hear the keys jingling. So you could actually hear him coming from a long ways away, and he'd come about once. And one time I remember I was juggling something, and we just heard the jingling of the keys, which actually was a pretty sound out of context. And I remember I did a routine to that as if that was my musical accompaniment. And then finally the guard showed up and the music stopped. And so the routine ended. But I never felt unsafe with the inmates and with the jugglers. And I think it's with any group of people when you know them one-on-one and deal with them as human beings. Then, some you like and some you don't. But it wasn't scary.
How did the inmates approach juggling? Was it different from you seeing Golden Gate Park or the juggling club?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think for a lot of us, juggling has saved our lives, you know, for a lot of people. And, you know, for a lot of us, it was something that we found that we had some affinity towards or attraction towards, or there was some attraction there, or maybe just one of those things that, gee, if I could only do that, you know. And so for them, I think it's very similar. I find kind of the more desperate the situation, the more meaningful it is. So here were people who had failed a lot in their lives and were very used to failure. And so for them, the idea of succeeding was extremely meaningful. I mean, I think succeeding is meaningful to all of us, but in that context, it was really meaningful. And they would work at something pretty hard and get it and really create beauty in a pretty ugly place. Lifers had a different sense of time, you know? And so I remember bringing the devil sticks one day, and, you know, which to me are really hard. It took me a really long time to get them. And, you know, they had no problem. You know, they were used to, you know, every time they would do it for 5 or 10 minutes and then do it again. And, you know, these guys have been in 10 or 15 years and had another 10 or 15 years to go. So they weren't as impatient, I feel, as some of us on the outside are in learning new tricks. And they worked really well together, too. One guy was an Olympic swimmer, like a champion swimmer or something. And you could see that same grace and that same discipline that he brought to juggling. You know, and he once said that he didn't know if he would ever go out there and compete again, swimming, or ever be out there again, but that at least he can bring those same qualities into this sense of grace and this the sense of beauty, even stamina that he was able to bring to it, too. You know, they work out a lot in prison, so there's some very huge men, and they're really, some are really muscle-bound, and they're not very flexible, too. So actually, juggling, I think, was really great for them because it worked them in a different way and gave them a different kind of, you know, dexterity that they don't get. So I think they really liked it for that, too. I don't know, and for me too, I mean, juggling had an addictive quality when I first started learning too, and I think a lot of people who are dealing with addictions, you know, that here's something else that they could do, you know, something they could have and something they could own. So they would be out in the yard and they could take out their bean bags and, you know, do some hot juggling for the other guys, and it was a community for them, and that's important in prison and on the outside, and it was something that they could, something that they could have, that was theirs. There were some good jugglers in those days.
The security in San Quentin was downgraded, so it became, went to a minimum security prison?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did that change things?
Really changed it. For me, you know, I like juggling a lot. Sounds trivial, but my main interest isn't technical juggling per se, and so although I like it and could teach it and really enjoy seeing hot juggling, you know, and I feel like when people get excited by that, but I did a lot of poetry with them in those days, and they loved it, and here are these lifers, and they had quite a lot to say, actually, and so there was stuff I was able to do within the maximum security, with the lifers, that was much harder to do with the minimum security guys, who were in for a few months, you know, no big deal, you know, wanted to learn to juggle to show their kids or to pass the time. It wasn't the same thing. It wasn't life or death, you know, it wasn't saving their life. It wasn't like their way of being creative in the world. It was something fun. It was a hobby. So it was a lot more meaningful in the maximum security. I had one guy who used to come in with these poems. They were the most vulgar poems I'd ever heard in my life. And I include your poetry in that. and so I was in a hard position, you know, as a teacher, and so I said to him, you know, that he couldn't say those poems in class, and that, but if he wanted to say them, he could censor them if he could say the word bleep, you know. So he proceeded to do this fabulous Lenny Bruce type routine where he would say what was essentially a rhyming poem and say bleep. So, of course, it was way funnier than the original poem, which was just stupid. So he would say da 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 bleep, and of course everyone knew what the word was. And then some lines were bleep bleep the bleep bleep bleep, you know. So it was really great, and he found very creative ways to juggle to that too. And I'll never forget one day he came in and he said, "I have a poem I'd like to perform today, but I didn't have time to work it out, you know, censoring it, and you know, with the bleeps. And but I'd still really like to do it." And I said, "No, you know, you can't do it." And when it was his turn to perform, he took one of the juggling scarves and he put it over his mouth in cowboy fashion, and he got up with three beanbags to juggle, and he said, "This is called the censored poet." Just proceeded to juggle without saying. So I thought it was great. People did great things. They brought in poems that I don't think they'd ever told anybody. And using juggling kind of as a mask, which some of us do, anyway. They recited these, I mean, like 14-page poems that they had committed to memory, and they were, you know, that they kind of made into these juggling pieces, and it was really beautiful and extraordinary. You know, and as you know, everyone found their form, and some people, like, you know, would do comedy shtick, and some people would do so-called aesthetic juggling or technical juggling or poetry and all that. But That was most interesting for me. When it changed to minimum security, it just became less meaningful. So it became a juggling class, and that was fun too. You know, and but also because they were there a much shorter time, they never became as good jugglers. Every so often, there'd be someone from. Every so often there'd be someone who would have some great, you know, have the gift, as we say, you know, someone would show up that just had that gift, and, you know, it would be really, really good, but mostly it was a hobby for them, and it was fun, and that's okay, too. I mean, nothing wrong with spending a nice evening juggling. But there are some great people, and as you know from your experiences there too, I mean, I met some great people, and just some, you know, and some of the most meaningful things that happened weren't with, you know, the great jugglers, and they were just with people who, I mean, just language. There was one guy who used to say, I used to show him a trick that I thought was in his capability, and he'd say, "Oh, I could never do that. Like, there's no way I could have." And after, you know, we were working together for a few months, and I noticed he started saying, "I can't do that yet," or like, "I can't do that without some practice." And just the idea that what seems impossible, we can do, which is such a nice lesson for life. And just learning how to juggle, like being in control of the objects, is such an amazing thing if you're not used to being in control of your life. And the idea that you can change the direction of a juggling pattern. So if you throw one ball a little bit too far in front of you and then the next ball a little bit too in front of that and you end up walking with the juggling pattern, the idea you can stop that and, you know, at any point change the pattern and bring it back to a normal pattern, that you're always in charge, it's an amazing thing for all of us, including people who aren't used to being in charge. So if there's behavior in our lives that's putting us out of, you know, changing our pattern, we can change that too. So this, I mean, it really, I mean, they're wonderful lessons, I think, in it.
Yeah. Did you ever run into any of your students outside the prison?
Yeah, I did. Yes. Actually, none of my juggling students. I ran into people that I knew from prison on the outside, and, you know, just said, "Hi, how's it going?" One of the things in prison, I think, is that we want to make a separation between us and them. And so they all look alike. they're all dressed in the same way, and we don't look like them, you know. And, you know, one of the first things I learned was that, you know, we want to make that separation and to think that, you know, there are criminals and there are non-criminals, but that's just not true. And I mean, this is obvious too, but, you know, one of the first things I learned was that there's not a great distinction between us and them, and we're all the same. And we could be in there next week for something, you know. And these are people, you know, who I know on the street. You know, I lived in the same neighborhood that they did, you know, when I first started working there. You know, and they say, oh, do you know, have you ever been to, you know, Mission Street? I'm like, oh, Mission Street? No, never, you know. And there I lived, like, you know, two blocks. Some of these guys, you know, are really glad are locked up. They really are dangerous. And others, you know, seem to be very nice and responsible people, too. One only hopes that when they go back outside, we'll find a way, you know, resources and a support system to continue that. It's a hard life. And there's just the hope that juggling supplies some way to find creative solutions and to create a bit of beauty in the world. And a way of interacting with other people that's healthy. So, for example, some of these guys, their wives would come to visit, and they would teach them how to juggle, or their kids. And they'd say, oh, my wife's coming, can I, you know, have three more beanbags? And, you know, this is revolutionary, you know, this kind of interaction. So it was really satisfying to be part of that.
Vacaville, when you started working there, that's maximum security again, and it also has the medical wing and the mental patients, is that?
Right. Well, Vacaville is maximum security because it's all levels. You don't get in there for the crime you committed. You get there for, like, your kind of mental or physical state. So because of that, it has to be maximum security because there are maximum security people there. So they have, like, a huge wheelchair-bound population, a huge blind population. And it's a hospital, basically. You have huge physical ailments and a big mentally ill population. It's got the biggest AIDS ward in the country. And there's a lot of illness there. There's a lot of dying. People die there. There's a hospice. People die there. So it's very, very heavy. Also, unlike San Quentin, it's all indoors. So all this energy stays indoors. It also has the highest transsexual population, transvestite and transsexual population. So it's a very interesting mix of people, and actually people are incredibly tolerant there. I mean, it's such a huge gay population there and such a huge transsexual population. So you have these officers who are often from rural and small conservative towns, and also the other inmates who are often from rural and small conservative towns, having to deal with, I won't say being outnumbered, but certainly having to deal with a substantial population that's transsexual, which is hard for many of the most progressive people to understand and live with, you know. So it's really an amazing, you know, social experiment. I would say it works, you know, in the extent that you know, you know, when you have to get along with people, you do. You just find a way to do that. So, but it was very heavy there. It kind of felt like a black hole. There was a lot of, you know, just desperate energy, and it was all contained. It was all contained. San Quentin, there was so much outdoors, you know. But I say that San Quentin was kind of modeled like as a college campus in a sense. But Vacaville's modeled like a high school, and there's hallways that go from one place to another. And I'd be teaching something, and I could hear people screaming, and pounding on doors. Or so often someone would be rolled by on a gurney, you know, completely strapped down and screaming, and just, our class was held in this hallway, like literally, like just through the hallway, you know, and like, oh, we had to move aside with our little juggling so this person can be wheeled by. So, but the weird part is, juggling fit in so much more there. I don't mean this in the wrong way, but it was like such a circus. You know, there was such crazy things going on there that there was nothing so weird about people juggling. It like fit in just fine, and everyone understood, the guards understood it. Like everyone got that it was like the logical thing to do. At San Quentin, it was always looked down upon, and well, you're doing what? But it made so much sense. So I dealt a lot with mentally ill patients that were so drugged up that they couldn't even look me in the eye. They were so glazed over. They were drooling. They had knife marks, you know, from attempted suicide marks up and down their arms. I would talk to them and think that they didn't understand a word I said, and then they would calmly take the scarves and start juggling. And it was amazing. It was amazing, the work that happened there. So in a way, it's the same thing, like the more desperate, the more creative we get. And that's who we are as human beings. I mean, that's just not prison. I mean, that's like anything, I think. And so it was really great. Sometimes I felt a little bit like a recreational therapist, which I don't even know what that means practically. But I know I got people working and doing it and feeling proud of it and making up pieces and applauding. And there was a lot of ways they were way more creative too, you know, fearless. You know, the drugs help. So that was really, it was powerful stuff. It was also around that time I started doing more theater work too. I just started getting more bored. I'd been teaching for so long. So we started adding more theater work there too. So that was really fun for me as well. And also, you know, just they were so limited that, you know, it was just, there was very little I could do with them juggling wise. So I had to add something there. But it's really great seeing, you know, the healing powers of juggling at the most basic level too. And you know this moment, because I know you teach a lot too, where I always call it the great aha, which is such a fun, that moment of discovery in anything is just so fun. I mean, that's one of the most fun things about being alive, is just discovering something or learning something new. So to be able to give people that moment of, oh, I can't do it, I can't do it. Oh, I get it, you know. It's really, isn't it?
Now you've had a chance to think.
So yeah, yes. Okay. We made a movie at San Quentin in the juggling class. And one of the guys wrote it. A few of us wrote it together, mostly one guy. And it was a fantasy, not nonverbal. And we cast a non-juggler in the starring role, whose name in prison was Snap. And we ended up calling the movie Snap. And he was kind of a hunchback guy. He was a weird guy. And it was a movie kind of about being an outsider. And so we found someone in prison who was an outsider. And so it starts off, he's in prison, and there's a soundtrack too, and it's turn, 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 and he's in prison, and he's in the yard, and he's alone, and he's walking, and he comes to the door, and he opens the door, and there are all these robots, and he taps each one, and they each kind of start juggling in turn, and then they drop, they juggle basically until they either drop or stop, and they return to being robots. And then one of them drops a gold ball, and he picks up the gold ball, and then it disappears from his hand, and then the room becomes a real circus. And there's just wild costumes and outlandish makeup and just wild things happening in the room, and he also becomes part of it and becomes in costume and starts manipulating some objects. And then at the end, you know, he turns and looks back, and they're all dressed as inmates again, and they're all robots. And then it just ends with him walking down the yard again, and you know, reaches into the pot. No, I think it falls from the sky. This gold ball again falls from the sky, and he picks it up and puts it in his pocket and keeps walking. And really, you know, about the magic that can happen. And to make the film, I brought in makeup artists, and we borrowed costumes from the Pickle Family Circus and from Make a Circus. And, you know, the movie we should have made was the movie about making the movie, you know. But they put on, you know, they had unbelievable, not clown makeup, but really wild, just wild facial makeup and just wild costumes. And we brought in these really wild costumes, and I thought people would want to be dressed. It was such a big deal to get out of their own clothes, which is unheard of in prison, that you can wear something else. So among the things we brought in were kind of regular clothes. And guess what? You know, the first thing that got taken up was the most outlandish, this wild hoop dress, which, you know, you would not be caught dead wearing in prison. That was like the first thing that went, you know. So, it was really great. And in a way, you know, I think the film is really, you know, metaphorically too about, you know, what can happen, just a little bit of the magic. You know, was it a circus or was it just these guys in prison? But just a little bit of the magic that we can bring anywhere we go. And also his name happened to be Snap, so we called it that. But also the things that can happen in, you know, in a snap. And that we're really free. I mean, that's what I learned in prison. I mean, that's what they taught me, is that, like, we're free in our spirit, and we're free in our body, and we're free in our mind. You know, and sometimes we have to do stuff we don't want to do, but the rest of us can really remain free, which is, I guess, one of the ways people survive in prison. And I guess the last thing, if you want to ask more, but that for me, I guess, think for anyone who went there, I mean, because I know you went there for a few times, and I'm able to bring people in occasionally, and it's really a blessing. And we always think about how we're bringing stuff to them, but we all know that we get as much out of it as they do. And I think it's really important that we, on the so-called outside, you know, see what kind of life it is for them inside, especially in California. And I don't know what it's like in Europe, but in California, where prison is, you know, is one of the biggest cottage industries here, to know that it's not all a picnic, and to know a little bit of what that life is like and who these people are that we're so quick to condemn. And one of the men in my class was on death row. Yeah. And it's multiple murder. This is back in the lifers. Multiple murder. And when California repealed the death penalty in 1972, he got life without, basically. And, you know, to have the opportunity to meet this man and to know him, I mean, I knew him for years, is, you know, it was an amazing thing. I mean, it was really a gift to spend time with some of these people who are really interesting people. So I feel for all of us, you know, juggling is magical and beautiful and challenging, and that it's a gift that works both ways in those situations.
What do you think was the worst thing or the worst experience that you remember from working in prison?
Oh, this is horrible to say, but actually the first thing that comes to mind is I actually got kind of sexually harassed by an officer who worked there. Hmm. And which was amazing because, you know, I had my guard up so often when I'm with the men, because especially with the lifers and being a woman alone with them and is, you know, it's psychically, I think, very heavy. So I wasn't really prepared for it with this officer. And then I went to my boss and told him about it. And no one could believe it. It was one of those typical situations, you know, this guy who was just so, you know, revered, you know, quiet and, you know, hardworking. You know, are you sure it was him? And, yeah, I was sure. So that was kind of scary. One time one guy came in extremely drunk or high. And that was a little scary. And I was scared. He sounded a bit suicidal to me. And I was put in an awkward position of kind of telling on him. And I did. And one reason was because I thought he was suicidal. So I thought it would be better that he get written up for drugs than that he killed himself, basically. So, yeah. I guess those are the, you know, the things that that come to mind in terms of like the worst things that have happened.
Are you likely to do it again, or have you given up on teaching prisoners?
Well, you know what I'm doing now. Do you know what I'm doing now?
Yeah.
I'm teaching in a halfway house in downtown San Francisco for men and women who are out of prison, just out of prison, on parole, most of them, and dealing with addictions. So, in a way, I'm also doing my halfway transition to getting out of prison, too. So I'm teaching there. I'm teaching clowning in theater, and we do juggling in the clowning troupe. And I'm also, I'm actually in a few weeks starting to teach at county jail too, so I'm not completely out. And, you know, this is a California Arts Council grant, and this will probably be my last year of it, so I imagine I will leave. I imagine I will leave. But teaching, directing this clown troupe has been really fun too. And that's been really great. And they perform for little kids. So now that we're in this halfway house, we have more access to the world. And so they can actually go out and we do these shows for little kids. And that's really, that's been really exciting. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'll go back and teach in prison. You know, I feel there's something about my personality that it's very interesting to me to work with what we call here special populations. That I always learn a lot, and I think I have something to give to them. But it might be someone else's turn to take it over and, you know, take over the programs that were started before me at San Quentin and even at Vacaville as well. I think I paid a price, you know, emotionally, you know, psychically. I think it was hard. It's hard being around it, and I only went in a couple of times a week, but there's something really hard about being there.
Mm-hmm.
My boss for a while at San Quentin was this Puerto Rican, part Puerto Rican woman from New York, and I told her once that how hard it was, and I really felt, you know, a bit damaged even from the work, from all the need there. And she said to me, "Hey, don't you know about throwing it in the water when you leave, you know?" I'm like, "God, now you tell me." Of course, San Quentin is on the bay, and it's so beautiful. I'm like, oh, you just throw it all in the water, all that tension. So I'm not sure. I don't know what the next step will be, too.
Let's I'd like to talk some more about your career as a juggler, as a performer, as an artist. But I think you have to deal with the info. How did you learn to juggle?
Oh, wow. Well, I was a student at UCLA, which isn't something I tell everybody. And I saw a juggling class advertised, and I thought I would take it. And it was 19...
Okay, sorry for the interruption.
That's okay. It was in 19... Well, are you just going to do this verbatim? You're not going to edit me out?
Yeah, I'll edit
you. Sorry for the interruption. And I should be really more careful how I choose my words. I didn't quite get that before. You're just transcribing this?
I have someone else transcribe it, then I will edit it down.
All right. Okay. Just to the witty parts, I hope. Yeah, I learned to juggle in 1978. I was a student at UCLA, and someone was offering this course. They had this thing, I forget what it was called, but anyone could teach anything, basically. So a guy named Edward Jackman was teaching a juggling class. So I always wanted to be one of those people that could juggle. I thought it was really cool. And I just wanted to be one of those people who could juggle and do crossword puzzles. So, yeah, I took this class, and it was really easy. I couldn't believe how easy it was. And I became friends with Edward, and he dropped out of school, and then I dropped out of school. Not for the same reason, but we stayed together a lot, and I hung out with his friends, his juggler friends, oh, I don't know, Peter Davidson, you know, just... But basically, you know, these great jugglers. And in fact, I was the only person I knew who juggled who was not working on seven balls. And I was a pretty good juggler, I think. I learned quite quickly, and I had a good knack for three-ball and four-ball stuff. I'm working on my four-ball juggling, whatever, and everyone I knew was juggling seven balls. So I didn't even consider that I was a juggler or that I was doing anything meaningful. I just thought, you know, anyone who's a real juggler was working on these incredibly hard tricks. So I learned what I would call classical juggling, if there's such a thing. I don't know. And there's a right way and a wrong way. You know, there's even a way to practice. And, you know, he taught that you practice a trick every, you know, third ball, and then every second, and then every one. And so I learned. Then after I dropped out of school, I moved back to New York, and I juggled at the juggling club there occasionally with John Grimaldi, I think his name was. And, you know, I kind of kept it up a little bit, and many, many, many years later, you know, went back to school at Berkeley, and something happened. Oh, yeah, I remember what happened. I was in Israel. I did a year of study in Israel, and we were in a bookstore. There's a women's bookstore and in Haifa. And I was in one room looking at these books, and I was with a friend, and I heard her talking to someone else, and I heard her saying, oh, yeah, we'll be there. What's the date? No, my friend knows how to juggle. She'll perform at it. You know, we'll be there. And I go in and I say, what's going on? She goes, oh, I got you this great gig. And I had never performed before, and it was a benefit for a women's bookstore in Jerusalem that they were trying to open. And so I had this gig. And so I performed at it, and it was really fun, and it was really easy. And I thought, well, this isn't so bad. You know, I kind of like this. So I did some performing in Israel that year. And the whole thing struck me very ironic, because I had been brought up in New York, and I lived in San Francisco and Berkeley and New York, which were really juggling centers. And it wasn't until Los Angeles, where I learned to juggle. And it wasn't until I, you know, lived in Israel that I was actually thought of myself as a juggler and that I could perform. And the reality was I was probably one of the best jugglers in the country at the time. So these same people, you know, couldn't go to Pier 39 or wherever and see all these hot jugglers. So, but I developed a style of performance, which I still have to this day, which is I felt that the juggling wasn't very good on its own, so I added written words, which I also thought weren't very good on their own. So, but I thought the two... Hey! That's a cool mask. You almost scared me. It's very beautiful.
Get a bed, Ian.
That's really great. Okay, good night. But I thought the two things together would make a complete picture, and it did. It seemed to work. So I was very happy with that method, and kind of performed that way for a while at, you know, various small events. Then I came back to the States, and I went to school at UC Berkeley, and I was very involved in the anti-nuke movement, and I did a lot of political benefits, and I performed at them a lot, using the same formula of the visuals kind of complementing what the words were saying. And I found out that as long as I was juggling, that I could say anything I wanted to say, and people would be very receptive. You know, this formula of, you know, as long as they're entertained, that they're really willing to listen. So that was fun for me. And so I learned to perform at political benefits, basically.
It seems like you're still using that formula, presenting, being, you know,
yeah,
a Jewish lesbian to...
Yeah.
Audiences that otherwise might not be receptive to that.
It's certainly true. And now, actually, well, you remember my first show was Beyond Brooklyn, and I saw a tape of that not too long ago, and I couldn't believe that every single scene had some kind of object manipulation in it. Every scene. And that, and, you know, by this point, I had, you know, I'd already worked for the Pickle Family Circus for 3 years where I did no verbal work. So I really, you know, I had some good juggling chops and a few other tricks up my sleeve that I learned from being with the Pickles, and certainly more of a certain style about how to present my body on stage physically. So it's really helpful for all of that. And then, but when I went back to my own solo performing, I went back to doing verbal stuff and writing stuff, and also using juggling metaphorically. And it amazed me in this first show, Beyond Brooklyn, which, as you say, deals a lot with Jewish identity and lesbian identity, and it's a story of someone who basically is trying to balance out her Brooklyn, New York Jewish childhood with her life as a lesbian artist in California. And juggling comes in very handy, metaphorically, as we all know. And anytime you want to talk about balance and contradictions, it works rather well. So I was able to do this whole show using all different kinds of juggling apparatus, basically, in each scene, a different one that told a different story or helped tell the story in different ways. But now I've started separating them out again to their kind of more pure form. And there's a way I really love to juggle separately from speaking. And I really love to really, really, really work on the words separately. And I don't want a visual to distract from what I'm trying to do with the words, you know, if it's not really going to add to it. So in my new show, June Bride, there's almost all the juggling and object work is separate from the text work, and there's a lot more writing and a lot more monologues in it. And that's really fun for me to go back and forth. And the well-known exception is the circumcision poem where I juggle these knives and do this poem about circumcision. But there's actually not a tremendous amount even of juggling in it. So, yeah, I'm like all of us, I'm trying to find my voice, I think, and I really love manipulating words and manipulating objects, and sometimes doing it at the same time and sometimes separating them out again to their original forms. That's the encapsulated version of my career.
What do you want to do next?
Yeah, right.
Or else we'll get it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to write another. I'd like to write another play, I think. And you sure someone wants it?
I think the answering machine just did. You'd like to write another play.
I'd like to write another play, and I'd like to continue doing solo work, you know, and exploring juggling. You know, the great thing about juggling is that it's so universal. So I could go to Alaska and talk about being a Jewish lesbian, which no one really understands in the community I'm performing in, and yet, you know, the visuals are so captivating, you know, and I feel, I mean, the one really big thing I learned was, because when I don't do the visuals, then I try to make the work humorous so that it's still, you know, a style I learned somewhere along the line was, you know, if the style is light, then the content can be heavy. And I was always very interested in heavy content. You know, that's just what interests me. And so, as you know, I wrote this play about the making of the atomic bomb, right? So there's some heavy stuff going on with that, but it was important for me also that it be a comedy. So I feel like I was able to enter the theater through juggling, and that it's juggling that has helped me find my voice as a writer also, and it's been a good friend to me, a really good friend. So, you know, there's a way I just love just going to the studio and just working it, you know, And when I was in the circus, and before I was in the circus, I used to, like, practice a lot. I mean, we've all put in those hours and hours and hours. And, you know, I used to get up at the crack of dawn and go practice before rehearsal even started. And there's a way, even though my work seems to be very different now, that I just love going back there and just working in a studio and feeling my body work and sweat and get cut from those stupid knives and throw balls around and ropes and sticks and explore it. I feel my work as a juggler isn't creative. Like, I'm not going to be the one who's going to make up new juggling tricks. But I might be the one who'll take that trick and put it in, you know, a very unusual context, for example.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.